So welcome everyone to this special event of LISI. It gives me great pleasure to welcome our two speakers tonight, both of whom have a very long-standing tie to LISI and have been visiting fellows here in the past. Our lead speaker this evening is Dimitar Bechev, and we're obviously here to launch his book, Rival Power, Russia and Southeast Europe. By way of background, Dimo is a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Centre. He's also a research fellow at the Centre of Slavic, Eurasian and East European Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and director of the European Policy Institute, a think tank based in Sofia, Bulgaria. He's published extensively in both academic and policy formats on EU foreign policy, the politics of Turkey and the Balkans, Russian foreign policy and energy security. He's also held research and teaching positions at Oxford and in Tokyo, as well as visiting fellowships at Harvard and London School of Economics, so here. From 2010 to 2014, he was head of the European Council on Foreign Relations Office in Sofia. Our other guest is Tim Judah, who, as I think all of you will know, covers the Balkans amongst, and sometimes other places, for The Economist. In the last few years, he spent a lot of time covering Ukraine for the New York Review of Books. He's the author of three books on the Balkans, The Serbs, History, Myth and Destruction of Yugoslavia, and Kosovo, War and Revenge. The third, Kosovo, What Everyone Needs to Know, was published at the end of 2008. His 2016 book, Wartime, Stories from Ukraine, was published. And from 1990 to 91, he lived in Bucharest and covered the aftermath of communism in Romania and Bulgaria for The Times and The Economist. After that, he moved to Belgrade for both publications in order to cover the war in Yugoslavia. He moved back to London in 1995, but continues to travel frequently to the region. In 2009, he was senior visiting fellow here at LISI. So on that note, Dimo, perhaps you could sort of introduce the book and sort of explain a little bit about how it came about, how you got the idea for it, and, you know, is Russia something to be feared?
Sure. That's working. Yeah, well, thanks James and Alex, everyone at LISI for organizing this event. It's very emotional for me because I actually started the whole project here with a fellow at LISI. So we've gone a full circle after all those years, and I'm really delighted, and thanks to you for turning up in such high numbers. It testifies to how popular Russia is these days, in popular, right? And to be a bit more cynical, I mean, these days people like Tim, if they want to pitch a story on the Balkans, the moment there is a Russian angle, interest perks up. For a long time, the region was off the radar, nothing really happened in the Balkans, same old, same old. But the moment the Ukraine crisis came on the radar, and the Russian presence became more visible in the region, mostly as a spoiler, then any story gets coverage as long as there's Russia. Sometimes to extremes, I must say, and I'll come back to this point. So the moment I got interested, I mean, obviously, if you live in Sofia, Russia is never too far. Russian interference, Russian meddling, Russian presence in the economy, but also society, has been a recurrent theme in the public debate in Bulgaria and also in other nearby countries. But I got really interested with the Ukraine crisis when polarization in society around the issue of whether to support sanctions or to push back and to denounce the fascist regime in Kiev became a prominent issue in the public space. And I thought it's an opening to actually think about more critically about Russian foreign policy influence in the Balkans, but also through a longer historical period, really since the collapse of the Soviet Union, to assess Russia's goals, to think about its strategy, and the dilemmas faced. And all the time, maybe it's in the nature of the profession, I started with some assumptions, but then you get to establish some rapport with your subject and understand the intrinsic motivation. So the book differs from many writings in the popular press on Russia in the region, in that it tries to be a bit more even-handed. Yes, Russia is up to no good. It is a spoiler in the way it wasn't just 10 years ago or 15 years ago. It is pushing against the West, but at the end of the day, it's not as omnipotent and influential people give it credit to. So you could read it both ways as a kind of an account of Russian meddling in the international affairs, but also domestic politics of the region, but also as a cautionary tale that at the end of the day, this set of countries, this cluster of countries, is being gradually absorbed in the West, and Russia plays at best a second fiddle. You can look at the numbers if you do the numbers, look at trade, human connectivity, even in places like Serbia, notably one of the closest allies of Russia, then you see that the point of gravity is not Russia, it's elsewhere. So the book tries to balance and present a balanced picture. One other theme in the book is, and it's something that I've developed a more long-standing interest in, is Russia's relations with Turkey, and Turkey is a somewhat different story. There you see this rivalry that turns into some sort of a qualified friendship. But it's always a caveat, and I was fortunate when I was drafting the book. It partly coincided with this period of crisis after the downing of the Russian jet over Syria, and then the dramatic turnaround in the summer of 2016 to the point that Russia and Turkey are now together trying to work out a solution in Syria. So in terms of geographic coverage, I go a bit further down south. There's a fair amount of stories about the Eastern Mediterranean and then even the Syria crisis. So I don't know if it worked out. I'd love to hear how what James and the team think about it. There are a number of countries. But yeah, if I finally, because I don't want to speak for way too long, I want to have questions rather and get into a conversation. But one thing that I try to impress on the reader is that one misconception is always to explain Russia's influence or presence through the lens of history, right? You have Serbia, you have Bulgaria, Greece, all those Slavic or Eastern Orthodox nations. Of course, Russia is influential because it's historically the big brother. And what the book is saying, first of all, history is more complicated. And if there's one bit of history that really matters, that's the Cold War. It's not the 19th century anti-Ottoman struggles. And it really depends what politicians pick and choose when it comes to history, what kind of references they make use of. So that's one. The other one is that in the mainstream coverage, it's always a story about the West versus Russia. And fair enough, what happens in the region is a reflection of the cycles. Russia being a partner, then turning into an enemy, then a partner again, all those ups and downs in the relationship over the past 25 years. But what's overlooked, in my opinion, is the local actors. So they're seen as a pawn, or pawns in this story, or the objects of policy, but that's not the case. If you dig a bit deeper into the stories, you see it's very often the tail wagging the dog. Russia is in this region not because it pushes, or not only because it wants to exert influence, but also because local governments, business interests, political parties, and so on and so forth engage Russia to serve their own agenda. And it's often a complicated relationship. I can go into much more detail and some cases. So that's one theme that is really important to take note. Be it because they want to enrich themselves, be it because they want to balance against their neighbors, or because they want to have a more even-handed relationship with the West, which is the main partner. And finally, if we think about Russian mischief, meddling in the region. The question we should be asking is not about Russian intentions, but about the enabling conditions. Russia is influential because of X number of problems in the countries themselves, to start with the captive state and corruption, also ethnic and other cultural cleavages that enable Russian interference, but also with the grievances, the grudges against the West. So if you think about Russian foreign policy or Russian presence in the region, again, I'm generalizing because we don't have that much time to go over each particular case. It doesn't rely on a great deal of resources. Russia doesn't have boots on the ground in former Yugoslavia. It did have peacekeepers, but Putin withdrew them in 2003. It's not promising billions upon billions by way of energy projects, which was the case in the 2000s. What it does is to shape the narrative, but it's a low-cost operation, because at the end of the day, there will be the receptive audience in many of those countries because of historical reasons, because of the grudges against the West. And that allows Moscow to be very present in the public mind and to have this outsized role. And it allows it to play this polar role and to push against the West as much as possible. So let me stop here, and then we can come back to some of those themes and get the conversation going.
Thank you, Dima. Tim.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm just going to say, a few brief words, because obviously the Dimitar is the star of the show this evening. So thank you for inviting me, and I would like to pay a debt of, I have a debt of gratitude. I mean, as you said, I kind of, as the Economist correspondent, have been covering this, covering the Western Balkans anyway, for a long time, and sometimes it seemed quite a lonely job, but now I have a sort of debt of gratitude, really, to the Russians for reviving interest in the region. I just had a look this morning. I thought, let's see what there is this morning. Here's from an American magazine. This was published on March 6th. How a Russian-linked shell company hired an ex-Trump aide to boost Albania's right-wing party in D.C. Did the Russians use the U.S. political system to fuel political discord in the Balkans? Then we've got... the ever-colourful Alexander Dugin in Skopje over the weekend, where he said, when they tell you that there is no alternative to EU and NATO, that represents blackmail, humiliation and colonisation. He said, urging the West to mind its own business instead of spreading its failed ideology. He then went on to call the US, NATO and the EU the fourth fascist Reich. Then we had Patriarch Kirill, the Russian patriarch, who was in Sofia the other day, who went home in a huff, annoyed at the Bulgarians for not showing enough gratitude for Russia's help in the liberation wars against the Ottomans. Here are some other stories from the last few days. Fancy Bears attack, this is quite serious, some Fancy Bears attack on the on Montenegrin government websites and hacking into Montenegrin government and state institution websites. Construction of a Russian-Serbian religious and cultural centre in Republika Srpska. And The Guardian had a story the other week about which included a story about Russian-trained paramilitaries in Republika Srpska. So that's just a kind of small selection. I mean, because nowadays you can read one of these stories basically every day. I thought I would tell you a little bit about the Russian humanitarians. Well, as they say, it's called the Russian Serbian Humanitarian Center in Niš in central Serbia. Since I'm probably one of the few people in the room who's actually been to visit it. When you go, and this is the so-called great spy center, which, well, I don't know, I mean, but when you go, they're very happy to show you boats, large boxes of food, tents, a small room with computers. It's very close to the airport, but it's not actually in the airport of Niš. And then the boss of the center moans because he says the center doesn't have diplomatic status. Unlike NATO, whose
soldiers can transit through Serbia without paying motorway tolls, that they have to pay motorway tolls, and that's very annoying, and that's one of the reasons why they should get diplomatic status. Other people are more cynical, and they think, well, actually, if you had diplomatic status, then you really could do something, possibly, perhaps with some nefarious intent. You could, for example, drive around some listening equipment in a van, and then the Serbian police or no one would have the right to ask you what was in your van. And just down the road, I'd like to remind you, from Niš, an hour, 2 hours down the road, is the Jug base, which is the Serbian army's only post-war new military base, where a lot of training takes place with Serbian troops, but also troops from the whole region every year. And it's in a strategic location. If you're going south down the motorway or the railway, it's up on the top of the hills on the left-hand side, overlooking Preševo Valley and overlooking Kosovo, where presumably you could maybe listen in, maybe easier to listen, or to anything that was happening in Kosovo. The other place, I've only been once to the centre, which has caused so much interest. The other place where I go quite regularly is North Mitrovica. There, for many years, the city was dominated, but there was a lot of posters of Vladimir Putin. And I was there, I remember going about, I can't remember, it was like 18 months ago. I went to see one of the local politicians. I was having a coffee with one of the local politicians, one of the old school ones, whose name is Marko Djuric, and he was complaining and saying, the Russians promised so much and they never deliver, they never give us anything, and we've asked them for so many things over the years. He said, for example, we wanted to get some money for teaching Russian, and they never even gave us that. And if we went to the Norwegian embassy and asked for some money for teaching Norwegian, we'd get it in a flash. His offices were then burned out. He went to see his burned out offices. And above his offices, on the square, just out across from the bridge from South Mitrovica, there were used to be pictures of Putin and the president of Belarus. Anyway. Possibly through disappointment with the Russians, those posters and those pictures of Putin, which were so prevalent, disappeared to be replaced at the time of the election of Donald Trump with lots of pictures of Donald Trump. And they didn't last very long. I mean, Putin lasted for about 10 years, and I think the Trump posters lasted for a few weeks. And they've all gone, not to be replaced with anything there, anything in its place. Coming down to the question of strategy, what did the Russians want to do? What they were quite open about what they wanted to do. They wanted to create a kind of group of four friendly countries, non-NATO countries, and keep them out of NATO, i.e. Macedonia, Montenegro, Serbia, and Bosnia through Republika Srpska. And they wanted to have create this kind of Russia-friendly bloc in the region. Now, there's quite a lot of reasons to be critical of the EU and critical of the West and gloomy about what the EU is doing and gloomy about what the West is doing. But if you frame it in terms of some competition between Russia and the West in the region, I'd say, actually, it looks like Russia's not doing too well at the moment. After all, whatever the story of whatever is the truth about the so-called coup attempt in Montenegro, Montenegro duly joined NATO. A new government, since last year, the new government in Macedonia is very keen on joining NATO and very pro-Western. And who knows what's going to happen in Serbia? What happens? I mean, out of the realms of possibility if sometime over the next year President Vucic comes up with a proposal for some form of compromise deal with Kosovo and the Kosovars accept it. I've even heard people suggesting that this would be kind of, and then going kind of full on in a kind of Western friendly fashion that this is a sort of 1948 redux. I mean, maybe that's an exaggeration, but anyway, if that happened, which is not, I say, not without outside of the realm of possibility, what use then is Serbia for Russia in the region for causing problems? Anyway, well, that remains to be seen whether that happens. But then you'd only have Republika Srpska as a kind of friendly place. But at the end of the day, Republika Srpska depends on Serbia. It doesn't depend on Russia. What are the main means, the main tools of Russia in the region? Well, obviously, we have sites like Sputnik, but people who've done analysis have identified about 20 kind of fake news sites, which basically push more or less the same stories every day, which then get picked up and used in the local press in Serbia, in Montenegro, and possibly elsewhere, which talk about Russian military glory, about NATO trembling at Russian military might. They attempt to sort of fuel a bit of hatred against Albanians or Croats, and this, I think, you know, for many of these stories are quite compelling. I think that's probably about it, actually. I think that's where I wanted to, those are the sort of few points I wanted to start off with. I just wanted to sort of echo, though, I think that what Dimitar said about some of the leaders, I think especially in Bosnia, but not only in Bosnia, but that there is an element of local leaders who are very adept at playing outsiders, and I think that's certainly the case in Bosnia, and to use your phrase, of tails wagging the dog. And I think at that point then I'm going to stop, and then we can open it up. I mean, the only other thing, actually, sorry, there was one other thing I wanted to say. If you ask people, certainly in Serbia, let's just stick with Serbia. If you ask people in Serbia, you know, who is the biggest help, who is the biggest donor to help to Serbia, Russia always comes top, and in fact, Russia basically gives virtually nothing. And people also believe that, as opposed to the EU and EU countries, and Russia is always, it's kind of believed because it has invested in NIS, the Serbian oil company, and kind of visible projects like that, that it must be a big investor. And I think probably buying, when it did buy NIS, Serbian oil company, that was a single very large investment. But since then, there hasn't been actually much investment. And certainly from the latest figures from the Serbian Investment website, it certainly doesn't figure in the figures of the top 10 countries who invest in Serbia. And I think that's more or less the same except for Montenegro, where it is the second largest investor. In the last year, it was the second largest investor after the United Arab Emirates. But the figure still was not so great. I mean, 54.7 million euros, okay, which makes it the second, but it's not that much, is it? Okay, at that point.
Thank you very much indeed. So we've got actually quite a lot of time for questions and answers, and I'll actually, if you don't mind, sort of get the ball rolling. I mean, I think it's sort of something that Tim had raised, and I think one of the things that I really enjoyed about the book is that it wasn't just on the Western Balkans. It sort of covered this whole arc across Southeast Europe. And, you know, as somebody who sort of works not just on the Western Balkans, but also what I guess is Eastern Mediterranean as well, there was a very interesting link that I think it exists in the way that Russia very often plays on people's sentiments of it being the supporter, the country it can rely on. And Tim had sort of said, you know, in the case of Serbia, if Kosovo is sold, then, you know, what's Russia's value to Serbia? And so there is a real sense, I think, for a lot of us who look at this, that Russia will not lift a finger to try and solve this issue. You know, everyone believes it. And the other case that I often think of is Cyprus as well, which you look at and very much dissent. But I often wonder, how does Russia get away with this? You know, it doesn't lift a finger to try and solve these problems. It doesn't put its hand into its pocket. And yet you have so many people who seem to believe that it's their great, you know, defender, and that it's there to help them. And, you know, actually all these other countries, such as UK and the United States, which actually are putting their hand in their pocket to try and find solutions, and, you know, all right, rather controversial in the case of Kosovo, but in through the EU trying to fund, you know, taking Serbia forward, taking Cyprus forward, you know, just seem to be regarded as, you know, against these countries. And it just is an enduring question in my mind. How does Moscow do it?
Well, I think it's often not by intention, but by default. And what I mean by that is the power of narrative, right? You have societies which have grudges against the West, in the case of Cyprus, to do with the division, in the case with Greece, going all the way to the time of the Civil War and the junta. I mean, it's a well-known fact that the levels of anti-Americanism in Greece are pretty high, rivaling only anti-Americanism in Turkey, where everybody has a conspiracy theory, both, of course, the pro-Erdogan side, but also the opposition, the seculars, have their favorite conspiracy theory of why America is at fault. And going up to the Western Balkans, the memories of intervention are still alive. I mean, it's an objective fact that Serbia, but also parts of Montenegro, were bombed in 1999. So it doesn't take much to blame the West for the traumas inflicted on the nation. And Russia is seen as a counterweight. I mean, you could probably have the same conversation in further down south in the Arab world. Why Russia is popular there, it's because it's seen as a counterweight. I mean, the interesting question to people who study international relations from a more systematic perspective is that soft power? I mean, what accounts to soft power? Is it the kind of constant reference that Russia is on the radar and people look up to Russia? Or is that too minimalist a definition? Because what we know is that soft power ultimately is the attraction of one's institutions, culture, and so on and so forth. And to be sure, there is a little bit of that in certain places. Again, Bulgaria would be the example. People, at least from the older generations, would read Russian, would use Russia as a reference. You don't need to be pro-Kremlin to be pro-Russian in that respect, by the way. You can have pro-Western people who follow Russian events, engage with Russian culture. But I don't believe that that's the case elsewhere, give or take. I mean, Greece, you have a constituency of people who migrated from the former Soviet Union in the 1990s. So there are some pockets of soft power in the proper definition, but most of the appeal Russia has to do with, again, the complex relationship with the West, that those societies historically, but also in more recent times, have been gravitating one way or another to the West, however you define the West, but at the same time they feel traumatized, or certain social groups feel traumatized, and scapegoats Western actors for everything that has gone bad. I mean, again, you can tell the history of the region in many different ways. And if you go back to this linkage to Russia, let's think about Serbia. I mean, historically for the Serbs, who was the big neighbor? It was the Habsburg monarchy. It was just across the river from Belgrade. This is where a lot of the church resided, the Serbian Orthodox Church. This is where a lot of people who built the monastery resided, and that was a big trading partner. So you can very well have a Habsburg-centric account, but it's not what is picked. So going back to your question, because I can ruminate away from it. The narrative structure kind of favors Russia, partly because that Russia doesn't have that much presence. In fact, you can make the argument that the closer you are to Russia, the more resentment you have. Romania would be the example. the kind of Russophobia that built in Romanian society and also impacted Romanian policy, even in the Cold War, was a reflection of geographic proximity. But that's only one element in a very complex equation. It's not just about your position on the map. It has to do with other issues as well.
Okay, thank you. So, questions from audience? Let's start.
Milica Sedelovic, I come from the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Two questions and one remark. You mentioned a soft power, and Tim mentioned that usually when asked, people tend to say that Russia is the big donor, whereas in fact, in reality, it's not one of the top 10. And normally, the polls would then have another question which says, when you confront them with reality, then the answer is, but there are no strings attached to Russian help. So whatever Russia gives, it's completely sort of motivated by attachment and love for. So that, I would say, is an element of soft power. And in terms of shaping the narrative, it's interesting because normally in Serbia you had always colorful ambassadors who were always playing the role of the spoiler in terms of European integration process, while Russia's trade interests and commercial interests generally were very well served by Serbia's progress towards European integration, in particular after signing the Stabilization and Association Agreement, which made transit actually cheaper towards Russia. And ever since they bought oil industry of Serbia, they were interested in getting EU grants and ultimately opened the Brussels office of NIS. Mm-hmm. And I think what normally doesn't, sort of people don't grasp is that Russia, if there is a disagreement, Russia's punishment tends to be more severe and more durable than that of the West. And I think Turkey is pretty much an illustrative example. And the two questions is Russia and Turkey, they're with what you said about their general, their relationship more generally, how do you see them in the Balkans, as allies or foes? And one with regard to Russia and the Western Balkans, is the current situation more of a result of Russia's intention or erosion of presence of the West, in particular the European Union and the US?
Thank you. Dima, I mean, quite a lot there to...
Russia and Turkey. I think the relationship doesn't have to do much with the Western Balkans. I mean, we see it in the Western Balkans. I mean, Turkish foreign policy now is almost entirely focused on the Middle East. And the point of gravity of Russian-Turkish interactions is Syria. And there is a little bit on the Black Sea and obviously the Caucasus. I don't see much going on in the Western Balkans. I mean, they are on the same page in the sense that they are external powers, but there are so many important differences. For example, at the end of the day, Turkey is part of the customs union. So it is integrated into the economic sphere of the West. And if you see it, the trade partners, the biggest trading partner of Turkey is Romania. And then Greece and Bulgaria rival for the second place. The Western Balkans don't come into the picture. Point is, Turkey's NATO, Turkey's customs union, despite Erdogan, despite the drift away, it is part of this family. And I would also argue that Turkey is of the region because of just the history of population and the human links. I mean, the person who founded Turkey as a modern state was born in Thessaloniki. So this tells you something. Russia is in a different position. It just right now happens that they have their own, each has problematic relationship with the West, and they by default and in the same camp. But I don't see much of a common cause in the Western Balkans. They work parallel, and each of them actually is probably influential, but each of them has encountered limits to their influence. I mean, Turkey was very confident, but look what happened. It's not the world, really. 2009, when it wanted to be the mediator in Bosnia. Erosion of presence, I mean, of course, it depends how we define that. Is there erosion of presence at the time when actually enlargement is continuing? There the summit, there's the Berlin process. I mean, you can be cynical and say this is only the heads of state and the big guys meeting. It doesn't trickle down to the daily lives of people. But, I mean, at the end of the day, the whole EU process continues for what it's worth. I don't see that much disengagement. Even the US. We tend to think that the US is over, is gone, but there is a second-rank diplomat going to Macedonia amid the crisis, and he gets things done, just knocking heads together. So I don't see that much disengagement. Maybe I'm wrong, but I see that the bottom line is that the West is there. The problem is that the this process of Europeanization, democratization, whatever you call it, tends to be very shallow because we as scholars, as pundits, fixed the bar very high. We expected that by Western intervention and the enlargement process, you can transform societies from the bottom. So there's a kind of complete transformation, if you will. And we are discovering now, not just in the Balkans, but also in Central Europe, sadly, that it's not very, it doesn't go very deep. Some old habits linger on. And I mean, if I have to make a prediction, you can imagine Serbia becoming a member state. So Kosovo is solved. It becomes a member state, say, in 10 years. What kind of member state it will be? It will be a member state like Denmark, or will it be a member state like Hungary? With the big guy on top and the media and subservient, and he goes to and gets all the EU money to feed the clientele, and that's the default scenario. So yeah, I mean the West is there, the pool is there, but the outcome is a bit more mixed than what we normatively want to happen. And then we have a conversation: what else we need to make it happen, but. Yeah, that's a long and somewhat depressing conversation, I'm afraid.
Tim?
Well, just a few brief points. I think actually people have talked about this erosion of the presence for so long now that actually we actually seen quite a lot of activity recently. We've got the new strategy document. We've got we've had the visit of Juncker in the region. We've got the Sofia summit coming up. Also the London summit coming up. So actually, sort of, quite a lot has been happening. I mean, you may say that it's
reactive.
Well, perhaps it is reactive, but it doesn't mean that it's not happening. I mean, perhaps people have listened to people like you going, the presence of the West has been eroded, and so they're actually reacting and doing something. But the other thing is a little bit kind of carrying on from what you were saying. I think one thing that sort of becomes ever clearer is that there's a kind of blurring now the distinction between between EU states and non-EU states. I mean, after all, is life so different in Serbia from life in Bulgaria? Not really, I don't think. I mean, there are differences, and the amount of money that Bulgaria gets from the EU is one of them. But as for ordinary people, you know, like. Okay, well, the right to work in the rest of the EU is obviously important, but for people who live in Bulgaria every day, like, I don't think there's not like life is that different from people who live in Serbia every day, and some of the problems are exactly the same, especially the demographic problem of shrinking population, which is not only a Balkan problem, obviously, but it's a problem of the whole region. And as for increasing authoritarianism that we've talked about for so long in the Western Balkans, well, actually, we're sort of blurring the distinction now with Hungary, with Poland, and, I mean, look at Romania as well, where one of the most successful EU projects of the last decade, pushing for the anti-corruption directorate DNA, which has put hundreds of politicians in jail, including a former prime minister and several ministers. And now you've got a government which is basically committed to getting rid of it because so many of them are so corrupt, basically. So I think we're seeing a sort of erosion of distinction between life in non-EU Balkans and life in EU Balkans and some of Central Europe. And attacks on the judiciary going as far north as Poland, of course.
Okay, gentleman there, if you could perhaps identify yourself as well.
Najam Abbas, East Western Student, Brussels. Dr. Bekir, to what extent you would say that Russia looks and defines its Crimea venture as a watershed? So would you consider that all pursuits in the region and what has prompted Russia to venture in Middle East, Libya, Yemen, Syria, is it a cause effect of what, did it cross a threshold that it would not never return back to? So how defining you would see that the Crimea adventure is for Russia?
It is pretty important, because that's a point where the relationship with the West kind of fractures, and it's been very difficult to shift gears, because the war in Georgia, many people thought it was this threshold, but ultimately with the reset and Medvedev in office, we went back to the cycle, and the cycle kind of went back to cooperation, where Crimea was a turning point in that regard. I'm not sure that, yeah, and then what happens in the Balkans is also a function of rivalry with the West. Essentially, Russia sees openings in the Balkans and tries to make life difficult for the U.S. and increasingly also the EU. The logic being that, from the point of view of the Kremlin, the West is meddling not just in places like Moldova, Ukraine, Georgia in the backyard, but also in Russia itself. So we reciprocate. We do the same to you in your periphery, the Balkans, but also increasingly in the core, in the Western countries. So that's how the Russians see it. The Crimean episode has also kind of more tactical implications, and it plays out differently in the Eastern Balkans, if you can call them that way, because these are countries that are a throw away from Crimea. So if Crimea is turning into a fortress and Russia is deploying more and more sophisticated weapons and building up its presence, it has changes the military balance vis-a-vis the NATO members in the Black Sea, Bulgaria, Romania, but also Turkey. So Russia's opportunities to use coercive diplomacy have gone up. This doesn't concern the Western Balkans that much, because they are outside the range, but it has impacted the calculus of those nations. So, yeah, again, as James rightly emphasized, it's not a book about the Balkans, it's a book of Southeast Europe. Mm-hmm. And you see different reactions depending on where you stand. I'm not so sure it has direct bearing on Syria and what happened in the Middle East. Maybe in the sense that, I mean, one of the payoffs of Syria for the Russians was that after the intervention, they managed to get the attention of the U.S. So just before September 2015, Obama didn't have much time for Putin. It was the Europeans in charge, the kind of Normandy 4, the Minsk Agreement. Hollande and Merkel were doing the heavy lifting. Well, once Russia appeared in Syria, then you saw engagement, which is exactly what Russians want. Let's sit and bargain now, and we have a bargaining chip. So that after the fracture, then you had the idea that the process of engagement. What didn't work out in Russia's favor is this idea that you could have a linkage, cooperate in Syria, and get concessions in Ukraine. It didn't play out that way. So that I see. And ultimately, the other thing to consider on a more military technical level is that Crimea has been the launch pad for much of the naval operations in the East Mediterranean. So the Russian expeditionary corps is being supplied from Crimea, not from other bases. So it's from Crimea that Russia asserted its presence in the East Mediterranean, which is a game changer because in the sense that after the peak in the early 70s, Moscow was absent from this strategic region, but now it's coming back. So yeah, there are connections, but some of those connections from Crimea are not as direct as we assume.
Well, I just wanted to return to the Balkans comment here, which is that some nationalists in Serbia like to say Kosovo is Serbia and Crimea is Russia. But I think actually for many people, especially in government, what happened in Crimea was excruciatingly difficult because you wanted to be friendly to Russia, but also and grateful to Russia for supporting you for supporting the territorial integrity of Serbia, when we're talking about Kosovo, of course. But if Russia was not supporting the territorial integrity of Ukraine, then what did it stand for? Then it wasn't a principled stance at all. It was just big power politics.
Lady there, about three rows in.
My name is Sandra. I'm a PhD student here at the LSE in the Department of Psychological and Human Science. My research interests kind of focus on the intergroup dynamics of international relations. And my question was in relation to the functional role that the kind of Russia meddling narrative serves in Western countries, namely this idea that, you know, nothing unites countries as much as the common enemy. So I'm wondering to what extent, especially with Brexit happening now and the EU being in a crisis, to what extent do you think that the kind of Russia meddling narrative becomes powerful in uniting these countries against a common enemy, and the consequences that this then has for those countries that have a historical sentiments towards Russia, but political aspirations towards the EU?
Thank you.
I don't think, I mean, that's an important point, but I think it's connects to the region in the sense that the narrative plays into the hands of elites. It's not the rally behind the flag that much. It's kind of trying to increase your value against the West. If you sit in Montenegro, I mean, Djukanovic and his lot, the moment that Russia appears on the stage and you have the alleged coup in Montenegro, that strengthens your argument for NATO enlargement. Now, that's what happened with the Senate ratification. The Montenegrins employed very well the narrative. And also, it provided an opportunity for the government to muffle the opposition in Montenegro. So it's the domestic and the international game. And equally, the other effect is that the moment Russia appears to be very intrusive, that opens opportunities for elites in the countries to dilute pressure from the West. I mean, you're Alexander Vucic, the president of Serbia. You go back to Brussels, you see Angela Merkel, Juncker, and others. And the moment Russia enters the conversation, you have a valid argument that if you rock the boat and press me too much on judicial reform, on being nice to civil society, on kind of allowing more freedom to media to criticize and hold accountable myself and those around me. Well, you know, Russia is there and it doesn't attach strings to the money, and Serbia can go to Russia. Of course, I deeply believe that it's a bluff, but sometimes it works. So you have, in other words, lots of ways to employ the narrative. I'm not sure if the main one is just to consolidate the nation against the Russian other. It's more in kind of more subtle way to outmaneuver whether the West, but also your potential opponents domestically. But it's there nonetheless, this dynamic.
Well, no, I don't think people are very united about it. I mean, first of all, let's just leave out Albania and Kosovo, or certainly Kosovo Albanians. But among Serbs and Montenegrins. I mean, people are quite divided, aren't they? Especially in,
sure.
in Montenegro, and in the Serbian government, you've got a kind of. I mean, people often say that Serbia wants to ride on two horses, and is this possible? I mean, to a certain extent, yes, it is possible. Anyway, for the moment, and you always have, you know, like, I mean, Vučić going to do whatever he needs to do in Brussels, etc. And then the foreign minister, Mr. Dačić, kind of making Russia friendly noises. And I think, you know, certainly in the intelligence services, I think that there's some divisions and sort of pro-Russian elements there. I don't think that there's a kind of it has acted in that united form. It hasn't acted as a way of uniting people or in the way that I understand your question. Anyway.
Gentleman there.
Oliver Guy, KPMG. I'd like to pose a question to each of the panellists. Dr. Fetcher, you said in your opening remarks that Russia wasn't really as involved in the Balkans 10 years ago. Around about that time, I was working as an analyst for the US State Department on Russian-European relations. And from what I could see, Russia was going on a huge spending spree across the region. You had, obviously, the transaction that Tim spoke about with Nice. Zelobyezhnev bought up pretty much all of Republika Srpska's oil infrastructure, especially the very interesting transaction with the Botanski Brod oil refinery. Lukoil was buying up petrol stations by the dozen in Macedonia and Bulgaria. There were rumours that it was interested that I think it was Lukoil was interested in taking a stake in Petrol, Slovenia's largest state-owned oil company. I think Russian influence in the region has been growing, certainly since that time and even before then. My question to Tim is, I agree with you, clearly interest in Russia's influence in the Balkans has woken up in the last few years. I wrote a lot of analysis on all those points that I just mentioned 8 years ago. And it's only now that there seems to be a real concerted effort to look at Russian influence there. Why do you think it's come about now? Is it because of sanctions and therefore Russia is seen as weaker? You mentioned the lack of investment. Obviously, sanctions is causing Russia some significant monetary issues. So is that the reason, or is it because the West thinks that actually this is something that they now need to be addressing, whereas 10 years ago it actually just wasn't such a big deal for them?
Yeah, I think I'm totally with you, actually. I didn't say Russia was absent. On the contrary, if you in the book, what I'm saying is this period you're talking about, starting from around 2006 up to the crisis in Crimea, the cancellation of South Stream, was probably, in objective terms, the peak of Russian influence. Because, first of all, there was money, there were the big energy projects, and also there was no pushback from the West, because at the end of the day, you could argue that those big ventures were of mutual interest. And it all worked together. The only moment of disengagement was in after the end of the Milosevic regime, so early the first term of Putin. But the moment the first Ukraine crisis happened and Southeast Europe appeared on the horizon as a possible bypass route, and then all those energy projects came. And by the way, I mean, Lukoil is an interesting case because it came into the region in 1998-99. The first privatization was in Romania. And it was not driven by geostrategic calculation. It was mostly to do with business opportunities, but also legacy. But yeah, I mean, the big energy diplomacy, that was a distinctive phase. And then Russia could do much more, the hands were untied. From 2008 to 2012, you had all the series of intergovernmental agreements with the South Stream. So each and every government downstream had a direct link to the Russians. there were expectations by the elites that there will be all kinds of side payments. The corruption machine was rolling. What I'm saying is that 2014 changed the dynamic. Now Russia doesn't have the money. It has much more confrontational relationship with the West. Part of the reason South Stream didn't happen is that this regulatory dispute, which could have been solved, kind of fell through because the European Commission didn't have any political will to find a compromise. And Russia chose a very different role. Instead of buying a building, footprint and investing in the local economy, creating leverage, it decided to be the spoiler. Russia didn't have any, the Russian foreign policy at the time didn't have any anti-European kind of tone in the discussion. There was a clear distinction, NATO is bad. Okay, we can actually live with NATO, we won't say it openly, we won't object to Albania and Croatia joining NATO, but certainly there were positive references to the EU, and the rhetoric changed now. There's been a shift in Russian foreign policy, low cost information warfare, whatever you call it, propaganda, investing small amounts of cash of all kinds of local proxies, shaping narrative, but all those carrots and the money that was splashed around is a thing of the past, I believe.
Let me just add, I think, yes, I totally agree. I think 2014 and Ukraine was a watershed. So things changed for the Balkans as well. And you don't forget that, I mean, and then since then, in the last few years, Russia has had a much more sort of aggressive policy, hasn't it? I don't know exactly what happened in Montenegro, but I certainly believe that something happened in Montenegro. We don't necessarily have to believe that there was a full-blown coup attempt, but I think there was something very, very strange involving Russia that happened in Montenegro. And you've got these kind of, you know, influential websites with the as I say, which I mentioned earlier on, all set up. I'm not sure, quite sure how they're funded, but all taking a kind of taking sort of news or stories from Russia or about Russia, glorifying Russia, and you know that does have some effect. So I think the whole context has changed since the period that you were talking about.
Okay, lady there. I'm going to start grouping together. Bernard.
I wanted to ask about orthodoxy, because that was one of the cleavages between Europe and a lot of the South East. How important is orthodoxy as a means of maintaining relationships, or how much is orthodoxy within Southeast Europe and that area actually highly fractured between the different patriarchs?
Yeah, we'll take those two and then.
No, you're absolutely right that Russian investment goes around the world way, and they count three examples. Lukoil is a Dutch company, it's headquartered in Rotterdam. The big privatization in Montenegro when Oleg Deripaska bought the aluminium smelter went through his operation in Cyprus, and Deripaska is a Cypriot citizen. And Sberbank, now famous for the Agrokor in Croatia, that's through the Viennese office. Which goes on to show that this analogy with the Cold War is somewhat problematic. Russia, today's Russia, is very much embedded into this globalized world, certainly in the networks in Europe. But still, I believe that the analysis is correct, that Russian investment, even if you factor in this roundabout ways of investment, is far behind that of certainly the Western Europeans. What goes for the Russians is two things. First of all, investment is concentrated in critical areas. You see the energy sector, which is very prone to corruption, it's highly intransparent, and there are all kinds of ways to exert political influence through it. For example, in Serbia, Serbiagas is a fiefdom of the party of Mr. Dacic. There is an intermediary company, so the question is what happens with the arbitrage, where is the money going? The classical question from Ukraine and other post-Soviet cases, there is a lot of ways to channel money into political parties through this kind of opaque structures. That's one. Secondly, one thing about Russian business is sometimes we assume they are the extension of the Kremlin. Connection is more complex. Lukoil didn't go to the Balkans again because it wanted to build to recover the Soviet Empire. It went there for gain. It's a private company, after all. But if tomorrow Mr. Putin or somebody else kind of summons the boss of Lukoil, Mr. Oleg Perov, and says, you have to perform certain services to the motherland, because you know how you develop a business, you know who is in charge here in this country, and is the ultimate guarantor of the wealth, then the relationship changes, and potentially all those energy firms can become geopolitical assets. Whether that's an effective way to employ economic power and what would be the ultimate outcome, I don't know, but the Russian state has opportunities to kind of assert its influence. The other thing is that the Russian state itself is captured, so some of what we see there is also a way to enrich people close to power. It's not coincidental that one of the big beneficiaries of South Stream would have been Mr. Timchenko, Gennady Timchenko. He's on the sanctions list. His company was chosen to build South Stream Bulgaria without any proper tendering procedure. So that's a lot of that going on. And the Russian, there's a huge gray area between Russian foreign policy and Russian business interests, between Russian state and the private entities that float around, which makes it an interesting subject of investigation. What will change Vucic's calculus? Well, if Serbian politics becomes more competitive, if there is real opposition to push for reform, and there is contest at the polls, combined with EU pressure, which is there, and pressure from civil society, then it will be a different ball game. Sadly, the Serbian political system has become very much centralized, which is
okay. Everyone, who's
signed up for a quiz.
I'm not sure I'm up for it, but I can say a few words about orthodoxy. Now, orthodoxy, that's the question, that's the way how you frame Russian foreign policy in this language of culture, brotherhood, history, religious bonds. Reality is a bit more complex than there's politics at play. Russia's relationship with some of the churches is strained, certainly with the ecumenical patriarchate. The Russians boycotted the big council in Crete in 2016. And that's it doesn't start yesterday. There's been a long rivalry. Russia's Orthodox Church has influence on some churches and less influence on others. One way to work it out is to look at biographies of the top clergy. Did they study in Moscow, in the Moscow Theological Academy, or did they study in the West, which is the case, by the way, of many people in the Serbia hierarchy. They were schooled in places like Paris, interestingly, by the then Church in Exile, before the merger, or the old Church of the Whites and in immigration. So, the big picture is Orthodox brothers, we love each other, but the politics is much more contentious. And that was brought home now with Patriarch Cyril. He's invited to Sofia. Putin was the original invitee, but it went sour because he was annoyed, not just because Bulgaria didn't pay enough respect, but the official Bulgarian line is, we thank Russia. But we also thank Poland, Lithuania, Finland, and so on, because there were people from all other nationalities fighting in the Tsarist army. And that was a bit too much for him to comment. But it's interesting, it was not a doctrinal issue, it was just pure politics, why Russia is not paid respect. It's interesting in itself.
Okay, I think Alex has disappeared to deal with this strange phantom speaker clash that we seem to have got. Gentleman there, if you could just... The microphone's coming over.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ewan Grant. I've worked in European Commission projects in Bosnia and in Ukraine and Moldova, and as a result of that, particularly in Ukraine and Moldova, I've seen the dark side of the European Commission. It's not always quite what certain idealists may suggest. My question for both of you, but it's based on Dr. Betchev's comments about Fortress Crimea and the geopolitics of that, and particularly the logistics for the Eastern Mediterranean and indeed beyond that. Frankly, I don't think the European Commission, and to a certain extent some EU member states, are particularly geopolitical, and they're sometimes uneasy in dealing with military matters. Are the Eastern Balkan states and those Western Balkan states which are members of NATO and the EU, or the Western Balkan states generally, are they getting any tangible thanks from EU Brussels or member states for, shall we say, information that may be of use as to what Russia is up to? And I do know that Bulgaria potentially has a role to play there. It's basically a question of, is Brussels, EU Brussels, has it got a strategic literacy, geopolitical literacy view to Russia since 2014 and in Crimea? Thank you.
Okay, and if Kurt, could pass the speaker forward.
Okay. Hi there. Kurt Kissinger, Democratization
Just two quick points and a question to both of you. In 2014, the first act that I thought that Russia took after Crimea was to encourage Dodik to accelerate his efforts toward pushing, which he's still pushing, more de facto independence, and he was basically told by Vucic, don't push it.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't for lack of effort, and Russia did encourage him to do that. I don't, to Tim, I wouldn't say it was disengagement. It's ineffectual Western engagement in the Western Balkans for over a decade. I mean, enlargement was supposed to, and still the theology is that the enlargement is supposed to solve this, even though you have demonstrable evidence that it's not working. And I don't think the new strategy really contends with that. And so that, plus the fact that the West hasn't really had a unified view on the region, particularly in threat assessment, that's most acute in Bosnia, but I'd say it pertains elsewhere too, is part of what's given Russia the ability to get the traction it has. So my question to both of you is, from my perspective, it looks like Russia's doing something the West still isn't really doing, which is trying to build beyond the elite level to a popular constituency level in Southeastern Europe. The EU thinks it's doing this, but really isn't. The United States hasn't really devoted itself to this since we closed down USIA. How deep are the roots that you see being set through controlling the narrative, as you said, Diva, particularly in social media, its influence through old media, cultural ties that may or may not be amplified fictively, but still have resonance. I'm just curious how deep you think those roots have gone in the past decade, and particularly in the past 5 years.
I think as we're running out of time, I'm going to take two more questions, and then we'll just do a run through. So, Misha. Short.
Okay. There was a question asked James, Misha Gavrilovich from Belgrade, which is, how does Russia get away with this? In other words, get some positive feedback, at least from Serbia. But I think it's 100% obvious. Mm-hmm. Russia hasn't dropped a single bomb on anyone in the Balkans. But 19 NATO states have done so and have flagrantly breached the UN Charter in doing this and have put international law outside. Republika Srpska has been bombed. The US has encouraged Oluja, Operation Storm, resulting in the biggest ethnic cleansing operation in the Balkans. And just a question for the two gentlemen that you have there. Have they not looked at the population census or census from Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and Kosovo? There are now more Bosnian Muslims in Bosnia. After all the ethnic cleansing and genocide and so on, and there are many, many more Albanians and hardly any Serbs in Kosovo. And as for Croatia, well, two-thirds at least are missing from there. But the population census says it. Have they actually looked at that?
And then there's gentlemen just there, and I think unfortunately this will probably have to be the final question.
Thank you. I'll make it brief. This is not actually to do with Russia.
Perhaps just introduce yourself if you don't mind.
Yeah, Harry Andrews, worked on various projects in the Western Balkans. This is actually about other superpowers, and obviously since 2014 the economic difficulties Russia's faced. I guess it's other superpowers and interests in the region in terms of investment, particularly from Gulf states and also China. Are these simply just economic interests, or is there a strategic play to those as well? Yes.
Yeah, all right. So what does the European Commission do in the Black Sea? Not much, because there's a division of labor. It's NATO. And NATO has done quite a bit over those years. There's the Framework Brigade in Romania. There's something they called Enhanced Forward Presence. It doesn't go as far as what you've seen in the Baltic countries. In other words, there are no British or German troops deployed there. But there is the brigade, and there is more naval presence compared to the Baltic, despite the limitations that the legal regime of the Black Sea implies. So that's the way to balance Russia. Whether the tripwires and the red lines are effective, we don't know. But certainly the NATO has upped the game. Well, the European Commission doesn't have to do much because there's somebody else in charge.
The European Commission can't do much. It's not our job.
Exactly, but should it do much, given that NATO is precisely there for that purpose? And, I'm not sure. Yeah, soft power. I don't think it goes that deep, but it does. I mean, just do a thought experiment. I mean, how many Russian actors or films the average serf has seen? Is Russian a language that is studied broadly? Would you, if there is a prominent Russian rock band, would you go listen to that? And so, I mean, on 8th of March, would you play Alla Pugacheva songs? But the raw definition of soft power doesn't quite apply. But it doesn't need to. As long as Russia banks on the anti-Western message that we are victims, but also you guys in Serbia are victims, and now it's time for payback to right the wrongs that the West inflicted on us, I think that's enough. Otherwise, I mean, it's the cult of Putin and little more beyond that that does the work. There's no connectivity at the cultural level that you might expect. And again, Cold War, 1948. Had it been otherwise with the Yugoslavia in the Russian sphere of influence, the cultural connections would have been much denser, as was the case in the 19th and early 20th century. But history is there. The more recent history, we shouldn't forget the latter part of the 20th century, as many people seem to do. And everybody is wronged in former Yugoslavia. The story you tell about the Serbs, I mean, the Bosniaks have their own story, and the Albanians have their own story. And the strength of Russian foreign policy is being able to manipulate those cleavages to serve itself. And it doesn't take much. It's amazing. You have Maria Zakharova, the spokeswoman of the foreign ministry, who is by no definition a major player. You issue a proclamation, and you take a stance on the latest developments in Macedonia, then all the local media pick it up. Then it makes the headlines, and then some news publications in the West play it up. Then you have some pro-Western people reacting, and it turns into this narrative of Russia rivaling the West because Russia is very vocal, and it creates this self-perpetuating dynamic of Russia as being back in the region. But it's virtual reality. But it's in this day and age when appearances and simulacra matter so much, it's not something. It's not irrelevant. And the irony is that everybody tends to benefit from inflating Russia's role. I mean, certainly Russia benefits because it looks really important and a competitor of the West without taking any risk, without sending troops or without splashing money in the region. People like Alexander Vucic benefit because they play the new T2's game, Russia, China, the West, and I'm right in the middle and I'm really important. And also, dare I say, the really committed pro-Western people, they are also complicit because they use the Russia scare to get their message heard. So all sides are complicit in this game. I mean, I'm not judging anyone, just the nature of the political process. So Russia is very skillful playing this game, but it's not a game played only by Russia. There are others involved. Some of the journalists as well, not you, but certainly. If you want to sell a Russian story once again, if you want to sell a Balkan story, I mean, Russia maybe China is the way to do it.
Kurt, your point about things being ineffectual, well, yes, I mean, to a certain extent they have been ineffectual, but we haven't thought of a better way of doing things up until now. I think that there is an element, though, that, you know, there is this, well, this soft power element, and the fact is that I would guess that there's probably more students from the region here at LSE than there are in Russia, and I think that those things are quite important as well in building a kind of friendly constituency. And, you know, Misha, I'm sorry, like, if you really want to talk about, like, 1999 or 1991 again, you know, then for every time one wants to start that argument, then one has to go back to saying, well, yes, I remember when Serbs drove out people from Krajina in 1991 and said this is revenge for 1941, and then people came back in 1999 and in Kosovo and also in Croatia, and they took their revenge. I mean, you know, that's what happens in wars, isn't it? But it's not really the subject of tonight, and it's one of those arguments which can go on forever.
Yeah, something I forgot. There was a question about the Gulf and China. I don't think they have a strategy, but from the perspective of Balkan politicians, they're a heaven sent, because very often you have those high-profile projects. They're done on the basis of intergovernmental agreements, so it's a way to bypass all kinds of rules and transparency in public procurement, and there are all kinds of side payments. Certainly the case with the Gulf money and all those prominent projects. China might have a long-term strategy in the way to assert influence in Europe, but also to have market opening, but it's still in the making. We'll find out in years to come. It's much less prominent than
it's not, but I think China just has a basic kind of commercial interest and an interest in having a kind of viable corridor from Piraeus to Central Europe and beyond. I don't think it's kind of much more than that. And making money.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Before I sort of say thank you to Dimitar and to Tim, just make a couple of quick announcements. First is that the next event that we're going to be holding is a joint Hellenic Observatory and LSE panel discussion, and that's this coming Monday, the 12th of March, and that's on Greek exports and corporate adjustment. And the speakers will be Professor Anthony Bartzokas, alternate board director at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and Dr. Peter Samphy, who is Deputy Director for Country Economics and Policy, Economics Policy and Governments Department at the EBRD as well. So that should be a very interesting event, and that will be at 6:30 and in Clement House 6.02. All the information is on the website. The other key announcement is to say that we are launching the book this evening. We've got copies at the back, and they're at a special reduced price, down from £20 to £15. It really is an excellent book. So for anyone who, you know, has been listening with a lot of interest this evening, I think we all have, really pick it up. It's very readable and incredibly interesting. And so on that note, I'd like to say a huge thank you to Demo for coming back. Welcome back. And the same to Tim. Thank you very much, you know, for this evening. Thank you.